Well, today's tax cut is really good for all the Kochs. It is Bill Koch's son, seen here wearing a shirt he designed, patterned in money bags, who has emerged as quite possibly the world's most perfect poster child for the Trump tax cut.
My father said to me, Wyatt, you can do whatever you want to in life, but just make sure you do it well and you do it with passion. Every day I go to the office, I enjoy creating the clothes. Be bold means to me, be authentic, be real, be yourself, be confident, and always be a gentleman. I want my shirts to be able to be worn in the boardroom or in a discoteca or a nightclub or on a yacht. I really wanted to create something that's fun, outside the box, cool, trendy, yet really bold and interesting.
So, shall we get started?
Yes.
All right. Welcome, listeners, to episode 8 of Know Your Enemy, the podcast about the American right and the American conservative movement, sponsored by Dissent Magazine. I'm Matt Sittman. I'm one of the podcast co-hosts, and I'm here with my friend, Sam Etherbell.
Hi, Matt.
How are you doing today, Sam?
I'm okay.
Doing okay?
I think of myself as your favorite bed bug.
Yeah, I just can't get rid of you. I've tried all kinds of things. It just keeps coming back.
Yeah.
Well, as we often do, we should begin with a little bit of housekeeping. We're going to keep this brief because we want to dive into the heart of this episode. Just as a reminder, we are now being sponsored by Dissent. And that means if you're a patron of ours on Patreon, for $10 or more, you get a free digital subscription to Dissent. So all of you who are supporting us, we thank you very much, but just a reminder of that special bonus offer. And please do, as always, rate and review us on iTunes. That's very helpful. Help spread the word. Most of the comments have been really favorable. Others, not so much. One or two negative ones, but that's okay. You can't please everyone.
Yeah, you really can't.
Well, let's get into it, Sam.
All right.
You know, Sam and I, we have lots of ideas for different episodes, but one of them that's kind of come to us via requests has been something on the Koch brothers and kind of the right-wing billionaires behind a lot of the funding of the conservative movement and the right.
We've talked we've talked on the podcast before about something called the pipeline in academia. How is it that the sort of radical ideas, fringe ideas of the right are mainstreamed in this sort of like very deliberate process with a lot of money behind it.
Right. And we decided to go ahead and jump into that this episode because of the death of David Koch recently, just in the last few days.
Think of this as our eulogy for the dearly departed David Koch.
Right, right. He died, I believe, on August 23rd. So just within about a week of the time we're recording this. And we're not going to focus on him or the Koch brothers entirely. But we thought the best way to get into this would be through Jane Mayer's book, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. And this book came out, I think, maybe 2016, and then came out, there's a new edition kind of with a new preface updated for Trump's victory where, that didn't exactly throw her thesis.
No, but it interestingly kind of
complicates
her thesis.
Right, and we'll get into that later. But for those of you following along, the text for this episode is Jane Mayer's book, Dark Money. Jane Mayer, the New Yorker writer and reporter, who's probably one of our finest investigative reporters.
Totally.
So she's if you're going to read one book, there's a lot on this, but hers is a pretty good place to start. And she draws on the work of other people. So, if you're reading along, you can dive into those other books or consider other titles to purchase and read.
And as usual, we'll put in the show notes other sources that we might have dipped into for this episode.
Right. And we'll mention some of those as we go along. One of them, just to mention at the start, is Theda Skocpol's review of this book in Dissent magazine.
And her book, too, on the Tea Party.
And her book on the Tea Party as well.
One more preview is that one thing that is always fun, I think, on the podcast is when we're able to bring in some of Matt's own experiences from his time as an up-and-coming right-wing intellectual. And because this is a lot of this is going to be about these institutions that he might have passed through or foundations that he might have been funded from at certain times, we're going to be able to bring to bear some of that personal experience.
Yes, I have been the beneficiary of the Koch brothers' largesse during my early days as a young right-winger.
Yeah.
So one reason we thought to turn to Jane Mayer's book is in part because it really does start with the Koch brothers.
Yeah.
And the Koch brothers are at the heart of the story she tells. She goes on to talk about a number of extremely wealthy right-wingers, Richard Mellon Scaife, the Bradley people, the Olin people.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just about the Koch brothers, because she gives these kind of really interesting potted biographies of a number of these people, which frankly is it kind of made for disgusting reading.
Yeah.
I mean, just the incredible amount of wealth these people have, all inherited, of course.
Yeah.
And then what they did with it and just kind of how,
right,
you know, the kind of dissolute lives some of these people live,
yeah,
as they're railing against, you know, the decline of morals and values in America. It's really kind of striking. And I was, before we started, I was talking to Sam. I said, at a certain point, some of the details in this book just start washing over you.
I know. You're stewing in it.
You're just stewing in it. And you find yourself kind of flipping through pages being like, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
This rich asshole did this or that. Or, you know, this employee of Koch Industries was like killed in an explosion,
yeah,
or died of cancer because of exposure to benzene or,
yeah,
mercury, or, you know, a whole town is, you know, destroyed because of mercury in the water or something like that. And it does, I mean, just it's relentless.
Yeah, the accumulation is just so damning and so revolting. And I was thinking as I was reading this, I mean, if you want like to get, you know, just to like recharge your deep class rage, this is a good one.
Right.
Just read Jane Mayer and then go out into the streets, because, yeah, it is so infuriating.
Yeah.
And, you know, like we have discussed a lot, like, about, you know, the title, Know Your Enemy. Like, what, like, is that appropriate for some of the people that we're describing? We're trying to be really fair. We are going to, like, you know, take people at their word and describe this whole system in a way that isn't just conspiratorial, but that's based on the reality. But I will say that I feel no compunction about describing these extraordinarily wealthy heirs to inherited wealth that was also derived from exploitation and horrible business practices as my enemy.
Right. Yeah. No. I have made a point in various, you know, episodes to say, you know, the enemy word is a little bit cheeky.
It is.
But I'm with Sam. Like, these, like, the Tea Party grandma is not my enemy.
Right.
Necessarily.
And Trump voters aren't our enemies necessarily. Yeah. But these people, these motherfuckers are our fucking enemies.
David
and
Charles Koch. Yeah. They were enemies.
Yeah.
I guess one of them is our remaining enemy.
Yeah.
So, you know, she does, as I said, she begins this book with the Koch brothers. And one of the things that I think was maybe not entirely unknown, but certainly something that I think she brought to much more prominent attention is the Daddy Kochs.
Yeah, the derivation of this fortune.
Daddy Koch, turns out he worked a lot for Hitler. And the Soviet Union.
Yeah, so he covered all his bases, you know. He built some factories for Stalin, built some factories for Hitler, made sure to equal opportunity tyrant supporter.
Right. Because he basically studied like engineering at MIT and figured out a way to refine oil.
Yeah.
To make gasoline, you know, including like high-end gasoline that could fuel Hitler's air force.
Yeah, I mean, you think about this, like, this wealth.
Hold on. He had trouble like kind of breaking into the American market because, you know, it was something new and like the established companies didn't want to like.
But those innovators.
In. Yeah, but there were people who were open to his ideas.
You might call them disruptors.
Right. Hitler was a disruptor of the oil and gasoline industry. But it is kind of interesting because, you know, like these were things that even the Nazi underlings were like, yeah. And then Hitler himself gave the okay for these refineries,
this
one in particular.
Like, Koch has a lieutenant who has a meeting with like top people in the Nazi party, and they weren't sure whether they have the authority to say, yes, let's do it. And then somebody gets message from Hitler being like, yeah, let's do it. Definitely. tell the Kochs we're on board.
Right. So that was kind of I mean, that really did provide significant windfall to the fledgling Coke industry.
And this is happening in the 30s. So like if you want to just be as crass as possible, like Coke, he's making his money helping build and fuel the war machine that slaughtered millions and millions and millions of people in Europe, including many, obviously, Americans, but also people all over the world.
Right, yeah. And he did eventually, so this is in the 30s, so basically when a sensitive person could be aware of what Hitler was up to.
Yeah.
This wasn't quite early enough to really have deniability, but he did in the 40s, I think, kind of pull back. And
it's pretty bad PR at that point to still be, you know, proud of that work. But, you know, Mayer is really careful about it because there's not enough in the record to really dispositively answer the question of how sympathetic Papa Coke was to Nazi ideas. But it is true that he hired for the boys a very Nazi-supporting German nanny.
Right, yeah. And in fact, her employment ended around the time Germany invaded France because she said she wanted to go back to Germany to celebrate with the Führer.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
he was impressed with German, you might say, discipline
yeah.
and manners. And had a lot of nice things to say about Mussolini, too.
Yeah.
There's a quote from Daddy Coke where he says, you know, it's the Germans and the Japanese and the Italians who really, you know, their people are working hard. They're the societies moving forward. And like,
yeah.
You know, in the context of the New Deal in the United States,
right.
You know, we're
lazy liberal democracy is making us, you know,
totally
chubby and soft. Docile,
soft.
One more thing I wanted to say is, and maybe we're going to get more into this, but you know, in terms of Papa Coke's politics, he was really big into the John Birch Society.
He was a founding member of the John Birch Society and attended the inaugural meeting that was held.
Which was like the deeply conspiratorial far-right anti-communist movement that we have talked about on earlier episodes.
Yeah, briefly. Like Dwight Eisenhower was a communist agent.
Yeah, according to the Birchers, yeah.
Yeah.
What is his name? Fred Welsh? Is that his name, the guy? Who is the...
Robert Welsh,
who the founder, had some really horrible racial ideas, too, and anti-Semitic and really just bad in every way.
Yeah, and that meant the brothers were kind of John Birch Society members, too.
Yes,
kind of
initially.
Early in their life. Like, yeah. they, like, whatever they later came to, you know, believe or their precise relationship with the John Birch Society, that was the politics they were reared in. That was like the what they stewed in as young people.
Yeah. And so let's do the family tree just quickly so people understand who we're talking about. So right. So we've got Papa Coke. There's the oldest brother is
Freddie.
Who is sort of the soft artistic one.
Sort of the black sheep. Yes. He did not really go into the family business. He studied playwriting at Yale.
Yeah.
He kind of lived a more aesthetic life, you might say.
Epicurean existence.
Yes. And it was claimed by the brothers, they basically tried to get him out of the family business. They tried to blackmail him by saying he was gay.
Yeah.
And he denied it.
Yeah.
We have no way of knowing.
But regardless, like the viciousness with which his brothers... tried to use his supposed sexuality to deny him access to the inherited wealth is really awful.
Yes. So you have Freddie, the oldest. Then you have Charles, who is still living and is really the kind of... I mean, he really ran the company.
He ran the company.
He's the one that turned the company from what he inherited from his father into something even bigger. And a lot of the business strategies, the acquisitions they made, and a lot of the political stuff too, he was, you know, he was really the one who rules the Coke empire with an iron fist. Then there were two twins.
Yeah.
David and...
William.
Bill, yes. And David, and one of the things Mayer does really well, as Sam kind of pointed out, is the family and childhood dynamics. So, like, Bill would always get picked on... But David kind of looked up to Charles.
Yeah.
And so it ends up being Charles and David that run the kind of Coke empire.
And part of the story, which we're probably not going to get into too much, but the story of these brothers is this basically decades and decades long litigation between Bill and David and Charles for like access to more wealth and control over the inheritance. And it's really nasty. And one thing that is relevant to this discussion is that you will find that in Mayer's book, oftentimes what she's deriving some of the evidence from is the court record, the record of this of these litigations, right. Because Bill is hiring investigators to look into all the horrible practices that his brothers are doing at his family named company.
Right, right. I mean, because some of it is he claimed that like when he was bought out, certain assets were undervalued, and so you learn a lot about how much money they have, what exactly they had, and then again to kind of. For leverage, Bill did, again, hired people to write like secret histories of the Coke in, organization
right.
and their companies.
And that stuff comes out.
And that's how we know
yeah.
a decent amount of what we know and that's featured in Mayer's book.
Thanks to sibling rivalry and just, the kind of like distorting, humanity-destroying aspects of inheritance and wealth, these people, we know some more things about them.
Yeah. And I think, I was telling Sam before we started recording, I think a vulgar Marxism is, often more correct than not or more correct than you might think. And this is where I also think an armchair Freudianism comes into play, because the kind of authoritarian, not just the German nanny, but like, working 12-hour days at a cattle ranch that
right.
the sons did to kind of toughen them up or like learn some lesson.
Yeah.
Like shoveling shit on a cattle ranch
right.
and these brutal 12-hour days, 7 days a week, they really, or they would be sent away to very like the Culver Academy in Indiana, which is a military academy, like these really yeah. toughen you up.
You're saying that they're dealing with some daddy issues.
They're dealing with some daddy's issues. And I think where it comes into play is something like, so they both want to vindicate the father
yeah.
by achieving maximum success in business and making
right.
Coke Industries greater than ever before, and the total inability to brook any compromise or any limits at all
right.
to their authority and say-so.
Yeah.
And I think that's clearly like the product of an overweening father, like
yeah.
where you never again will you be under the thumb of another man, basically.
Right, right, exactly.
In the way they were growing up.
Right.
So that's kind of the Koch family. And then what Mayer does is just sort of give you an overview of some of the business decisions they made. Koch Industries is a privately held company.
Yeah.
So one thing, they take their profits, they plow it back into the business
right.
because they don't have to pay dividends to shareholders. And that allows them to acquire more. So she talks about those kind of business details and kind of how they... both their kind of ideological formation, their early efforts at political education and this like freedom school.
That Charles is really into this freedom school, which is a lot of like fringe libertarian
right.
People. And one of the like big kind of narratives that's being pushed by the people who are involved with the freedom school that Charles, attends and supports is that, that the New Deal historiography is wrong. Like that in fact, like the robber barons were good. And at one point, Mayer quotes from this guy, Gus de Zerga, who was kind of in the Koch fold earlier on and somewhat close to Charles Koch, who eventually is sort of an apostate and does like talk to her and talks to other people who've written books about them. But she quotes him as saying, if you grew up with more money than God and felt weird about it, this version of history where the robber barons were heroes would certainly make you feel better.
Totally.
And I do find that like one way of making sense of like this entire their entire life's work in my head is just this kind of crass effort to justify what is so plainly and obviously an unjustifiable existence.
Yeah, yeah. And it's worth pointing out too that Charles Koch in particular, I think, was something of a autodidact. Like while his father was still living and he returned to kind of work for the family business, he immersed himself in a lot of the like libertarian literature, you might say, and libertarian economic ideas. And so part of the trajectory of this book is these sons, Charles and David in particular, kind of reared with fringe ideas, John Birch Society, radical libertarian ideas, this freedom school. And then in 1980, David Koch runs as the vice presidential candidate for the Libertarian Party.
Yeah.
And so what I'm getting at is they kind of went from the fringe to the center of American life. What happens is they eventually just kind of are tired of losing.
Yeah.
And they realize they kind of got to play the game more.
Yeah.
It's these fringe ideas aren't working.
Right.
And like in 1980, when the Libertarian Party got like 1% of the vote, that was kind of this,
it
was this inflection point, because they kind of soured on electoral politics. So they both knew they kind of had to take a step back and think more about the intellectual infrastructure behind some of these policy ideas. And then, but even in the 80s, you know, they thought Reagan was a bit of a sellout.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until the 90s that they start being like the co-chair of Bob Dole's campaign.
Right.
Like who you wouldn't necessarily expect to be their absolute favorite,
right,
even though he is from Kansas, as they are.
Like even like Bill Buckley describes them as like total nut jobs, like in the earlier part of the second half of the 20th century. So they are not at the center of American politics in the way that they are now,
right,
for much of this story, actually.
Yeah.
And that like reminds me that one thing I wanted to bring up is to sort of like frame this discussion is like a lot of time the way people talk about, there's kind of a tension all the time and a slippage between the ideological agenda that the Kochs, and all, as well as the Scaifes and the Bradleys and all of these people we're going to talk about, there's a slippage between the ideology that they support and their sort of narrow pecuniary financial interest, right?
Right.
Where, like, obviously, like, if you support libertarian economics, you're deregulatory, you're doing something that will help your company's profits. So there's a direct interest-based connection there. And often the way people talk about people like the Kochs, and it's not unjustified, is these are people who are funding, they're just part of the cost of doing business in America is funding all of this shit to make sure that there's political conditions for your extraordinarily profitable companies to thrive without being taxed as much by the state and without being regulated. But also, there is a genuine ideological agenda, and the fact that the Kochs for so long are so shitty at actually like fundamentally changing American politics, but they're still pouring money into supporting libertarian ideas and libertarian politics, suggests that their hearts are really in it. And obviously, like, that's what ideology is that slippage, basically, between your position in society and your concept of the good. So, like, ultimately what I'm saying is that they're not really distinct, but that one can be a true believer and not just a cynical person who's supporting these ideas for the sake of profit, and still ultimately your ideology is rooted in material factors.
Right, right. Now, before we get into some of the mechanics of their kind of move to the center of American political life, it's worth saying that after Mayer talks about the Kochs, she talks about a number of other kind of heirs, inherited giant fortunes that then funded various foundations on the right. So she talks about Lyndon Harry Bradley, famous for the Bradley Foundation, the Olin fortune.
Yeah, John M. Olin.
Yeah, which funded the Olin Foundation, the Earhart money, which funded the Earhart Foundation. And so she kind of walks you through some of the biggest names, Richard Mellon Scaife, I should say, not to leave him out, because he's one of the more important ones.
Right.
The name Mellon should give you a sense of where his money came from.
Yeah.
But he was important because he was kind of crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, a little more off kilter than the Koch brothers, who are, whatever else you think of them, kind of relentless and disciplined. He was a big funder of all the research that went into the Clintons in the 90s. The kind of Arkansas Project, funding the American Spectator, funding these private investigations into, you know, all these things, Whitewater, Vince Foster, et cetera. The Scaife Foundation is another one.
You also remember that someone who's come up in news more recently is Cordelia Scaife May, also a Mellon Scaife May heiress, who basically funded the modern anti-immigration movement.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah.
So some of what the Koch brothers did borrowed, you might say, from these other foundations, and some of the personnel would hop from foundation to foundation.
It's hard to keep track. Like this guy, Michael Joyce, and this guy, Fink, Richard, what's his name? Dick Fink.
Yeah.
Dick Fink. This guy's name is Dick Fink, and he's very closely involved with the Kochs various times.
Someone even points out in the book, could there have been a more appropriately named man?
Yeah. But yeah, I guess part of it is that like we're going to start talking about like what these foundations did and what the sort of theory behind their effort to change American politics was. Sometimes it's going to be like this was like mostly Koch money. Sometimes it was mostly Scaife money. Sometimes it was mostly Olin money. And like the distinctions between these are not going to be super important for our purposes.
Right.
It's also just really hard to keep track.
Yeah. You know, we talk about the post-war American conservative movement, and that makes it seem like there came this moment in American history when people had this realization.
Yeah.
This kind of band of dissident intellectuals that we've talked about before. But it's also worth pointing out there are material. It's not just like ideas percolating at a certain time. It's noteworthy that a lot of the conservative movement took shape as all these rich assholes inherited hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars that they put into these foundations that were tax exempt, or rather they only had to pay taxes on what the dividend produced, or what the principal produced. Sorry. And
that wealth is inherited.
Yeah. And so you did that for 10 to 20 years, depending on the precise arrangements. And then you were scot-free. The money was yours to kind of, and you might have to spend a certain percentage of on it of that money on certain kinds of projects. Or so you have all these people inheriting this money
from their industrialist daddies who made a lot of money from the war.
Right. From government largesse.
Yeah.
The government contracts. So you have all these. The ludicrousness of it kind of boggles the mind. These rich people inherit all this money from their fathers who made a bunch of money from the government, mostly in the war effort. And all this money's in foundations because they were looking for ways to hand this money down that didn't require it being taxed or to go into the public coffers.
Yeah. They create these foundations, you know, like that's the other thing. It's important to orient yourself here. Like every time you see a foundation with a name, even like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, what you have to understand is partially what that purpose of that foundation is to protect this wealth from diminishing over time. By taxation in the course of their lives, but also for the purposes of inheritance.
Right.
And so basically you're shielding massive amounts of wealth from democratic control. It's just straightforwardly anti-democratic.
Yes.
And it's the idea that basically these people go, okay, I've got hundreds of millions of dollars. I want my kids to get hundreds of millions of dollars. And the government wants to, you know, tax it. And then the public is going to make decisions about how the small portion of it that's taken away is going to be spent. And my choice is no. I want to make all the decisions about how my money is spent, even for quote unquote public good, philanthropic good. And the extra step that the right wing folks do is to say, to expand the meaning of philanthropic good to building political conditions for the flourishing of their companies and to take over mainstream politics with fringe right-wing ideas.
And just to hop off that point, Sam, one thing that Mayer got at in her book that I genuinely was not aware of was the history of these foundations. And so she details this kind of congressional debate that like the subject of basically shielding money from the democratic process through these kind of tax-advantaged foundations.
Yeah.
Was a subject of vigorous congressional debate. And at the time, people were like,
no, you can't do this.
They clearly saw what was happening.
Yeah.
People saw this for what it was at the very start.
Yeah. And that's the important thing to keep in mind. Like that kind of, that way of thinking about foundations and philanthropy has kind of fallen out of our consciousness. But when these foundations were really started in earnest, there was this debate about like, okay, you're just going to stash away all your wealth. That's public. That should be ours. And that's honestly how we should be thinking about it again.
This has been an over century-long war waged by the wealthiest Americans to protect their wealth, shield it from taxation and democratic control, pass it on to their children, and then they're actually deploying then the resources of these foundations to keep them as rich as possible, to keep their businesses as unregulated as possible, to, again, influence politics as much as possible to make the conditions favorable to them and their businesses.
It's really, we could say, a lot of synergy at work here. They really identified a synergistic way to approach this problem of the public.
Yeah. Now, how do they go about using all this money they have piles of in these foundations to influence American politics? Well, there's a lot we could say, but one thing that I think really gets at the heart of, well, what's actually true and what ended up proving effective and what I experienced as a right winger is this three-pronged process or this three-step process that our pal Dickie Fink outlined in a talk or paper he gave called The Structure of Social Change. And this was something he pitched to the Koch brothers, Charles Koch in particular. And it's a three-phase takeover of American politics. And here I'm going to read from Mayer's book. Quote, "The first phase required an investment in intellectuals whose ideas would serve as the raw products. The second required an investment in think tanks that would turn the ideas into marketable policies. And the third phase required the subsidization of citizens groups that would, along with special interests, pressure elected officials to implement the policies. It was, in essence, a libertarian production line waiting only to be bought, assembled, and switched on, end quote. So great writing from Mayer to kind of pick up the almost like factory, the industrial kind of quality.
One thing
this.
That she does pick up on, too, is that Fink would have talked about it that way to Charles Koch because he knew that would appeal to him.
Right.
So he wants to think of society and everything as sort of functioning as like a factory.
Right. Yeah. No, that language of like business model appealed to Koch. And it is, we don't need to go on too much of a sidetrack on this, but one of the funnier things is, as Sam pointed out, like this was an all-encompassing worldview for Charles Koch. And so he came up with this bullshit thing called market-based management.
Oh, God.
And wrote a book about it called The Science of Success. And the point is that like market structures, like every level of a company.
Yeah.
So like in theory, like lower employees can come up with ideas.
Yeah.
Like, you know, but also like it's all based on competition and like earning bonuses by meeting certain metrics. And you kind of have to prove your existence in the company by like proving the value you're earning for them. So it's like taking market competition and like the most cutthroat, like capitalist competition and applying it at every level of a company.
Right. So you can imagine it's really fun to work for these companies that Koch runs and that he inspires other people to run.
Yeah. And I should be careful how I say this, but I do remember. Back in my conservative days, I had a number of friends who worked for the Institute for Humane Studies, the outfit at George Mason University.
We gotta talk about that.
Yeah, we'll talk about this more later. But they would always they'd have to like sit through these seminars about market based management.
Oh my God!
And these were like, you know, you might disagree with them, but these were mostly people who like took seriously the ideas of libertarianism, who worked for IHS because they cared about like Hayek or whatever
Austrian economics.
And they're sitting in these market based management seminars and just like, oh my God. But so that three pronged approach is basically the core of the model. And it makes sense, right? Like you have academics and intellectuals come up with the kind of ideological underpinnings. You have think tanks that kind of turn that into policies. And then you also have the pressure groups that kind of, you know, get politicians to get on board with these policies.
And one of the things that at some point Mayer points out is that the Kochs realize that the approach that you should be taking is to writing the scripts for this whole process should produce the scripts that politicians who are functionally just actors on a stage read.
Right.
You know, this is how you disseminate ideas, not by exclusively by, although they do that much more later, funding particular politicians, but by writing the scripts that that politicians will eventually use and say.
Right. Yeah. So it is much more sophisticated in a way, or at least more complicated than simply giving a politician a handful of cash.
Yeah.
Because that's also one of the few, even after Citizens United, there are still like some limits of what you can give directly to politicians.
Yeah. Quid pro quo doesn't always go as far as you want.
Right. It's not about the quid pro quo. It's about the status quo. And who, you know, and how that's defined. And as Sam said, the kind of what's in the air, the script, the language, what's considered salient, how people talk
about it. What's normal.
What's normal. Right.
It's much more effective to change the dominant common sense through this deliberate process.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of this three-pronged strategy in more detail. But before we do, Sam, did you want to hop on the Powell memo stuff?
Oh, I wanted to say that. Yeah.
Well, this is worth kind of laying out, I think,
A little bit, yeah. Well, there's this sort of famous document that's called the Powell memo. It was written by Lewis Powell, who would very soon after writing it actually be appointed to the Supreme Court.
He basically went from being like R.J. Reynolds in a tobacco stooge to the Supreme Court.
I know, it's incredible. It's
like now, honestly, the Republicans would nominate and confirm an axe murderer probably, but it is kind of amazing that
He's a corporate lawyer. He's on the board of Philip Morris. And that's important because he sees what is happening to the cigarette companies in the 60s where, you know, people are figuring out the horrible things they're doing. And he's like, this is a great injustice.
Yeah, like they're regulating cigarettes now. What's next? Companies can't dump poison into our water.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that he thinks is that one of the things that he advocates is that there should be given equal time to people, scientists who say cigarettes are good and scientists who say cigarettes are bad. Which
both sides, baby.
Which is now very much, you know, kind of the way that climate change is approached for a very long time by the media. And that's some of Powell's influence. And the Powell memo is this thing that he writes in 1971. And it is another version of this kind of systematic model for how massive amounts of corporate money can be used to change the dominant common sense and to push right-wing ideas. Now, it should be said that there's some number of histories of the sort of right-wing money machine, which treats the Powell memo as sort of as the key cause and sort of catalytic moment in a way that is sort of facile and ultimately not correct. The idea is that, so Richard Scaife and Joseph Kors reads the Powell memo, and suddenly they're like, okay, I need to start a foundation that does all of these things, or I need to use my foundation to do all these things. And that's not really right. But I think that it is fair to think about the Powell memo as sort of an expression of a set of ideas that are circulating about how to reframe spending, political spending, in that moment. So it is important in that way. And I think one of the key takeaways from the Powell memo, too, is one of the things he's saying is that it's not enough just to defend your company's narrow profit interest. What you have to do is defend the market system as such, because it's under attack in the initially by the New Deal, but now again by the 1960s radicals.
The universities loom large.
Yeah. And actually, Powell is obsessed with Ralph Nader. He says that the most effective and the most dangerous person on the side of the backlash to the corporate world is Ralph Nader and the consumerist movement. But yeah, so I just wanted to read a couple things for the Powell memo, just so you get a flavor of what that ferment is like. Powell is really insistent that at this point, business leaders have no power, no influence over politics, which is definitely not true at all. But he writes, yet, as every business executive knows, few elements of American society today have as little influence in government as the American businessman, the corporation, or even the millions of corporate stockholders. If one doubts this, let him undertake the role of quote-unquote lobbyist for the business point of view before congressional committees. The idea being that lobbyists are the most hated people. And he says, one does not exaggerate to say that in terms of political influence with respect to the course of legislation and government action, the American business executive is truly the forgotten man. Which is patently absurd and was absurd at the time, but if you think about the audience he's trying to reach to convince these masters of industry and super wealthy people to get them terrified. And the thing is, to listen to his approach, this is really effective language. And you have to also understand the context of as the 60s. These people, there's Marxists in the streets, Marxists on the campuses, and the idea that there's going to be some communist revolution is in the air, and you see the civil rights movement. There's an anecdote from the book about, from Mayer's book about John M. Olin, who we'll talk about later, his Olin Foundation becomes really important in funding various research institutes, where he's a graduate of Cornell and he's really involved with the university. In 1969, he watches as the Black Student Union marches on the administration and demands the creation of, a Black Studies program. And they're all Black powered out. They have afros and some of them are carrying guns, and they're all influenced by the Black Panther Party. And he sees this and he's so terrified and scandalized that that's one of the big things that inspires him to start using the Olin Foundation as a vehicle for pushing right-wing ideas and defending American democracy, which is to say, defending American white supremacy. But the last thing about the Powell memo I'll say is that he identifies these different places where the right needs to get influence. And the big things are the campus, in Congress, obviously, and the judiciary. Yes. So he says really explicitly, the left has the ACLU. They have an organization that's explicitly trying to, in his mind, push this liberal agenda using the courts, identifying cases to take on, and the right doesn't have the same thing. The essential thesis of the Powell memo is the threat to the enterprise system is not merely a matter of economics. It is also a threat to individual freedom. Mm-hmm. And so it's giving, again, it's like giving a script to these extraordinary wealthy people who have these foundations. And part of what it does is give this language in which to defend their personal interests in this kind of heroic, in these heroic libertarian terms. And that becomes really important.
And kind of the American way of life is being lost.
Yeah.
And one other thing to point out is that all this kind of meets a fortuitous moment or an auspicious moment because, Watergate happens, right? So a lot of the anti-government stuff, like all this is ramping up in the 70s. Again, you get the creation of the Federal Society, the Heritage Foundation, et cetera. A lot of these think tanks and a lot, and with the Powell Memo, there's a lot coming together in the 70s, and it's happening just as Nixon's impeached. So people start to lose faith in government. And in fact, Mayer points out that it was somewhere in the 1980s, like in the midst of Reagan's presidency, that for the first time in a long time, maybe ever, Americans had more faith in business than the government.
Yeah.
And that is a result of Watergate and kind of the Vietnam War and, you know, a kind of loss of faith in our institutions. And the Sam kind of got at this when he mentioned the ACLU, but you have these institutions that are kind of moderately liberal, like the Brookings Institute, like the ACLU,
Ford Foundation,
who, again, it's not that they had no kind of political valence at all, but it's that they did think of themselves as being generally in the public interest, basing their recommendations on like social science and reason and like widely accepted academic ideas. And these institutions were totally unprepared for what was coming.
Yeah.
Because, again, the language of, as Powell pointed out, with like, oh, you should have equal time for the critics of cigarettes and the defenders of cigarettes. That was the language the right used to get these ideas mainstream.
You got to found the Heritage Foundation because...
But once you have something like the Heritage Foundation, that means on any issue of public policy or any political dispute, and you're writing a newspaper article about it, you quote, you know, say a Brookings study, and then you cite a Heritage study, and that's being fair to both sides and capturing the debate. So by essentially ramping up these institutions on the right, that was... kind of creating the conditions for both sidesism, because previously there had not been an ideologically motivated right-wing set of institutions that could provide you with the talking points and policy studies and whatnot that allowed the both sides stuff to actually have something substantive to it on both ends.
Yeah. So, it's the 1970s. We got Heritage Foundation 1973, right? Mm-hmm. The Cato Institute is also founded in the 70s.
Maybe like 1980, but close.
Yeah. So that, and the Cato Institute is really Koch, baby, right? That's just like, let's go
at
hard.
The start.
Let's go hard libertarian. Like, this isn't going to be like even at, you know, we're not going to entertain all this other shit. It's going to be libertarian. And Charles Koch really runs the Cato Institute in the beginning with
an iron fist. Yeah.
Everything goes through Koch.
Yeah. He eventually exits.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about how this plan plays out. Yeah. And what does it look like? And what does this network look like?
Yeah. Well, the three-part kind of the three phases is a good kind of sketch to keep in mind, because some of what these foundations do is establish beachheads at prominent universities.
So that concept is important. What is the beachhead?
Well, often it means you find a sympathetic professor who's already there, who starts an institute or a center. Like one of the big examples they give is the... at Harvard University, run mostly by Harvey Mansfield, called the Program on Constitutional Government.
Yeah.
And one of the things they always point out is you have to give it an innocuous name.
All the time.
So, like, who could be opposed to a program on constitutional government?
Yeah. Name it after a famous figure from the founders or whatever, Madison or, you know.
Right. Or at Brown's, you know, something Sam experienced, the Political Theory Project.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Or to get to the naming thing. When I was at Georgetown, I mentioned in a previous episode that I'd helped Patrick Deneen start the Tocqueville Forum, which would bring in speakers and funnel money to grad students and all that kind of thing. But again, like, it's Tocqueville. So it's this like widely read and respected 19th century French, political writer who wrote Democracy in America. And it's, like, you know, who can object to Tocqueville?
It's basically it's important not to call your, academic institute at Harvard, the Harvard Institute for Deregulation and wealth maximization or whatever, you know. But the beachhead idea is important too, because these people realize that they can't just fund these right-wing colleges. We don't want to have, like, a lot of the figures that whose academic work they want to lift up, they aren't at that moment working at the most prestigious universities, because libertarian ideas, far-right libertarian ideas, weren't really in the mainstream of the university discourse at that moment. And so they realize, what we need to do is have a beachhead within these sort of liberal institutions.
Right.
We need to establish these little institutes at the best, at the most prestigious places, because that's how we get the imprimatur of the name
right.
of Harvard, of Brown, of...
Right. Of, so some study or paper comes out of one of these institutes that has the... The great example of this is the stuff that the Mercatus Institute does at George Mason. And, you know, if you just saw a newspaper article where it quotes a scholar or expert from the Mercatus Institute at George Mason, you would just naturally assume that this is an academic figure at a reasonably well-respected university.
Yeah.
So some of it is... you know, research-based, like at the Mercatus Institute. Some of it is less libertarian. Again, like Harvey Mansfield's not a libertarian. One thing it does do is it also provides funds for these scholars who have managed to get tenure at prestigious institutions to help their graduate students and help them network. And it kind of does provide professional development and support to kind of like a new generation of scholars. So, and a lot of the Earhart money would go to graduate fellowships.
Right.
I at one point got Earhart money.
Yeah.
And it's not very, like on the surface, it's not that insidious. It's
yeah.
just like a professor who's tapped into the Earhart money says, oh, like you're doing interesting work. Like, you know, do you have money for the summer research you're doing? Do you need your tuition paid for a semester? If your tuition's paid, you need a stipend to live off of. So for graduate students, and they spread this money around pretty liberally, like you don't have to be a right-wing ideologue to get some of this money. It's more like, are you sort of a reasonably, in the context of the academy, a reasonably friendly graduate student? So the beachheads at universities kind of function that way. They allow someone like Mansfield at Harvard to support graduate students, to bring in guest speakers, to have seminars and programs. And it's just a way of like getting these ideas into the university's bloodstream,
yeah.
and helping to connect, both junior, like graduate students to more senior scholars who might come in to like give a talk or something,
right.
and just also provide the funding for grad students, as I mentioned.
I won't dwell on it too long, but I don't usually get to talk from my own experience about this stuff because I'm the leftist born and bred voice on this podcast. But the Political Theory Project started while I was at Brown in 2009, I think, 2008, 2009. But it was run by a guy named John Tomasi, who is a libertarian sort of political philosopher, I guess. And he, in fact, it isn't like these people are, you know, siloed into their little weird thing that they're working on. He taught the Intro to Political Thought like lecture course that I took my freshman year at Brown. And it became clear as he was moving through these thinkers that he was a libertarian and that he had an agenda, but he's got access to 200, Brown undergraduates who he can sort of subtly influence to that way of thinking, which of course every professor does that to some degree, regardless of their ideology. I will say Tomasi was a real piece of shit. A bad teacher. He sort of had this like rock star professor vibe because he was like kind of like handsome and like made a lot of jokes in his lectures, but he was a shitty teacher. And he assigned for the final paper of that course his unpublished manuscript for his book about economic freedom, which was really horrible. And I remember like my friends, you know, we were freshmen, so we didn't really know. We were like, is this normal? Like, this is such a bad book, and it's like not published. It's clearly not copy edited. It's like really bad. And you know, I wrote like my final paper eviscerating his book, which luckily a TA graded. Tomasi is quoted in the Mayer book saying something to the effect of, you know, he has this. The Political Theory Project, which is getting all this right-wing money, allows him to teach a freshman seminar. And he says something like, you know, slyly, if you fill their heads with two semesters of Hayek in their first year in college, it's hard for them to shake that the rest of the time.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
yeah.
there's like some amount of like, it's not always that insidious, but in sometimes it is kind of like, how are we going to fill these heads with the right ideas?
Yeah. And I think it's one qualification to this or one addendum is like someone like John Tomasi, he got tenure at Brown on his own.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, but what you realize is that in every department, there's probably one or two right wingers. Like most of academia is not that conservative, at least in the ideological sense.
Yeah.
And what the money does, what these foundations and institutes do when they establish these beachheads, is essentially create a multiplier effect. So you might only have one John Tomasi in the politics program at Brown, but this money allows him to teach a seminar like this.
And bring the graduate students that he wants.
Bring the graduate students along, perhaps, but then also hire postdocs.
Yeah.
Like the Brown postdoc at the political theory program was considered, in my days as a grad student on the right, one of the plum perches you could get. And that's really important because, A, every grad student needs to figure out something to do in between finishing their PhD and getting their first tenure track job. And so this provides kind of some cushion.
Yeah.
They have a couple years to maybe turn papers into articles, get their first book out, and they get the Brown imprimatur.
Right.
Which helps them get jobs down the line.
Yeah. So those are beachheads. I did want to say another thing about another thing that they do, or another while we're on the topic of higher education, there's also like fellowships, right? Which is, you know, similar but distinct. Like the Olin Fellows, by the John M. Olin Foundation, is a really important one that that Mayer talks about, because all of these people who became really prominent on the right got this fellowship. And Michael Joyce, who we mentioned a few times, who's moved through these different foundations, he says at some point that the Olin Fellows, and this would apply too to the people who get postdocs at the Political Theory Project or who, whatever, are working at these institutes. Joyce says of the Olin Fellows, he thinks of it as a quote-unquote wine collection, the Fellows, because they would grow more valuable as they age and increase their stature and power. So, you know, you get them early, you get them on the cheap. They're just starting out in their careers. But you know, if you're funding these, you know, people who are moving through these elite institutions, that at some point, maybe they're going to be in positions of extraordinary power.
Right.
And it really does work that way, right? So like
yeah.
John Yoo was associated with this fellowship.
Maybe the greatest example of this is Charles Murray.
Yes. Yes.
Now, I forget where his pot of money came from, but Mayer points out that Charles Murray was essentially a kind of not that accomplished, I think he did do a PhD, but like he was working in some government office doing like statistics or crunching numbers or something like that. He was not well known. But then like somehow some of his research came to the attention of one of these money men.
Mike Joyce.
Owen Foundation. So it was Joyce, yeah. And it's amazing. Like, so they got him an op-ed basically testing out the ideas he would write at length about in Losing Ground, his book on welfare, so-called reform in 1984. This is how it worked. They got him the op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, which caught the attention of more and more people, right? But then they basically gave him the money to work on Losing Ground.
Yeah.
And then eventually he got, you know, these plum gigs at right-wing think tanks, probably most prominently eventually at AEI.
Yeah.
So this is a really concrete example of a guy who was toiling in obscurity. They got him the op-ed that caught the attention, that got him the book, which they themselves made sure he had the money to have the time to work on it. And then got a like one of these chairs at a think tank.
And even more importantly, Losing Ground is like the ideological foundation of welfare reform, which a Democratic president puts into effect.
Yes.
So the degree to which you can normalize a set of ideas that are fringe and make them into such a common sense that somebody like Bill Clinton has to say, basically, Charles Murray's right.
Yeah. So if you're wondering, I know we're throwing a lot of like names of billionaires and foundations and talking about a lot. Some of it's somewhat abstract, but a good concrete example is Charles Murray, because it's talk about the pipeline, like, again, from toiling in obscurity to being the guy who set the terms of the welfare reform debate in the United States. He was cultivated every step by this right-wing money.
Yeah.
From the initial op-ed to the chair at AEI to the book that was in between.
Yeah.
He's the perfect example.
Yeah. And Joyce, just while we're on him, just for the last little bit on him, he has a good quote in the book. I don't remember where or when and to whom he said this, but he basically said that describing this whole system, the overarching purpose, he said, was to use philanthropy to wage a war of ideas. And that's exactly what they did. We should talk about GMU a little bit.
Sure.
So George Mason University, not really like you hear that name and now you know it, right? But
right.
like at the time when it first started, sort of got the attention of these people, it wasn't particularly well known. It was,
yeah, it was like a commuter school. Like
yeah,
it
in D.C. or yeah. outside of D.C. So.
Yeah, it's in Fairfax. So yeah. It was a public university in the University of Virginia or the Virginia State like system. But it was, again, it's more of a commuter school. It wasn't extremely highly regarded. But I do think a lot of its prominence is because of all the money the Cokes have put into it. And like their law school program, I believe, is now a top 25 law school.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the home to a lot of the law and economics stuff.
Yeah.
But also they have the Mercatus Center, which is more of a research kind of institute of sorts. But then the Institute for Humane Studies is
talk about the fucking empty signifier names. Institute for Humane Studies.
Right. <Yeah. laughs> Right. 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 Again, one of these blasé names. And IHS, the Institute for Humane Studies, is a group that I had a lot of dealings with as a young conservative.
Yeah. What was that like?
Well, I'll just tell the stories. I have to say, as I've said many times on this show, I was treated extremely well by them. And in some ways, I tell these stories because it is almost, it's less insidious than sometimes the big picture things would lead you to believe. And the way IHS worked is that, there were like different levels to it. So they had like a summer seminar that was like maybe a week long. The one I went to, I think, was at the University of Virginia's campus. And they cast a wide net. And these kind of first layer of seminars, it's, you don't have to be a dyed-in-the-wool libertarian to go. And it's mostly grad students. And what they do is you attend seminars and lectures and you do some readings ahead of time. And the goal is maybe to find someone like me who is a more committed ideologue that mm-hmm. then moves through the program's different levels. But also, let's say you're just a kind of middling, moderate, whatever. The goal is so maybe you, when you become a professor and it comes time for you to write a syllabus on 20th century political thought or political ideologies, it gives you a kind of access to what Hayek wrote or what von Mises wrote. Or what Milton Friedman wrote.
Right.
And, it gives you kind of sympathetic exposure to those ideas, and maybe then it finds its way into your syllabus, and maybe you talk about it in a more sympathetic way than you would have otherwise. But then, and this is something I think the left can really learn from, because I was, a real believer.
Yeah.
I was flagged as, like, real potential.
A really good potential bottle of wine.
Right, yeah. And so they would give you a Koch fellowship, like money, just like $5,000, let's say, to help you get through the summer, things like that. But then you would be tapped for more specialized seminars. So like one time, to give an example, I had already done the like beginning level seminar where it's, 100 people at a campus and it's the cast a wide net. But then I was chosen for a weekend in Chicago at a fancy hotel. To do nothing but spend like 2 days talking about Hayek's Constitution of Liberty.
Uh-huh.
And the way these things work is you get the book mailed to you like a month or two ahead of time. You read the book. There's maybe some study guide questions. And then like a senior scholar, someone who actually maybe has written a book on Hayek or is really familiar with his work, leads the seminar of maybe 15 to 20 people. And you just spend that weekend talking about these ideas. And the thing is, they don't require anything of you.
Yeah.
It's not like they said, now you go back to your university and proselytize, or when you become a professor, we expect this of you. It's much more like, it really is about the ideas. And a lot of the people the program officers, they believe this stuff too. It's again, not that they change their views because of the money. It's that these centers then, attract like-minded people.
Right.
And then the other thing they do, and again, this is something maybe the left can learn from, is kind of the next level is like, let's say you are an advanced PhD student. You could apply for a program where, let's say you wanted to get a peer-reviewed article published. Mm-hmm. When you had a draft of that paper, they would set up a weekend where like they would contact their network of scholars and give you intense feedback about that article.
Wow.
It would basically be a workshop to improve your writing, whether that's a book manuscript or an article manuscript. And, I never did that in particular, but it's a really...
It's appealing.
It's extremely useful to a graduate student.
I feel like one thing is that like one of the reasons that this stuff is effective is that it wouldn't be effective really to put a bunch of graduate students in a room and tell them whatever you do with your life, you got to make sure to protect the wealth of the Koch family even just like you need to be a libertarian economist or you need to your political theory needs to embrace Hayek. But they approach it in the language of academia, of academic freedom, and the ideas being the focus, and also they provide the things that graduate students like most fundamentally need and want and cherish, so that you are kind of grateful.
Yes, that's a really good point to make, Sam, because there are certain ways you simply have to behave to make it in academia.
Yeah.
And one of the publications that IHS has, I think it's called Scaling the Ivory Tower, mm-hmm. by, I think it was written by the Duke economist Michael Munger. Mm-hmm. But it's basically like, listen, this is how you break through academia. First of all, don't have a dumb blog where you spout all your political opinions.
Right.
Here's how you do peer-reviewed articles. Here's how to spend your time in graduate school most effectively. Here's what hiring committees look for. And it's all about acquiring the correct and proper academic credentials to make it. And that's advice that doesn't necessarily have an ideological edge, but it was geared toward people like me who were ideological outliers in academia. And
right.
But the advice itself was simply what you needed to do to make it. So that kind of professional development was a big part of what they did. And frankly, they do it well. The people involved are often generous and thoughtful people. And again, the advice I got was good advice.
And I was going to say, too, though, it's about providing this space in which to, wade into the ideas and allow them to simmer. But also, it's about building prestige and creating social and professional networks that are going to be helpful, right? So, you were that fellow, and, I remember you from that, and I'm going to hire you now at Heritage Foundation or at this or that or place. There's a kind of there's no squeamishness about that kind of nepotistic networking on the right, the way that there really is on the left. And there's, as we always say, the right cultivates this idea of being an embattled minority wherever they are, the ideas at least are embattled, and that so we need to stick together and we need to be tight and tighten it and we need to help each other out. You're a right winger, I'm gonna help you out. I can see from your application that you did this fellowship and that fellowship, we're gonna hire you here for that reason. All right, before we get away from GMU and campus stuff, we should talk about law and economics.
Right.
And law and economics it's a good example of a very fringe set of ideas that is mainstreamed, and mainstreamed very much with the financial support of one of these foundations.
Right.
We should say first, law and economics is a way of thinking, legal thinking, that tries to bring the economic perspective in. It's that when you make judicial decisions, you should be thinking about the effect on the market and doing this kind of balancing out of interests.
Right. The economic efficiency of this or that rule or regulation or decision or whatever.
Efficiency and clarity. Yeah. And in the 70s, this was not a mainstream idea.
Yeah. The rise of law and economics is totally in the last, since the mid to late 70s.
Last quarter of the 20th century. And it's really a good example of how this money can really make a huge difference, because, as Mayer points out, 68, that there was no interest, there was no particular interest in this set of ideas. Olin Foundation funds it to the tune of $68 million, and that between 1984 and 1989, 83% of the funding for all programming in law and economics is coming from the Olin Foundation.
Right.
So, if you want to think about, does the money ever translate really into a fundamental change in the common sense thinking? Law and economics is a good example of that.
And it really is, George Mason is kind of the bastion of this.
Right.
And it's for a couple reasons. One is Henry Mann.
Yeah, and Henry Mann is at GMU, but then it's actually this interesting moment where there's this controversy at Harvard, because apparently, some of the law professors are telling their students to left-wing students to infiltrate corporate law firms in order to have, basically undermine, sabotage corporate legal practice. And this comes out, and Mann actually takes advantage of this moment in order to like call up Olin, and Olin uses this opportunity to negotiate with Harvard to establish the John M. Olin Center for Law, Economics, and Business.
Oh, right. Yeah, there was, so this controversy kind of put Harvard back on its heels and to kind of cover its ass and say, see, we're really balanced. We'll take all this Olin money and kind of, you know, pay lip service to or facilitate these ideas.
Conservative ideas. It's another both sides moment.
Totally.
And but James Pearson?
James Pearson is the Olin guy, yeah.
Yeah, he's the Olin guy. And he says it is quoted in Mayer's book, another example of the floating signifier, like law and economics. That doesn't necessarily sound so bad. You like law, you like economics. Maybe you want to study law and economics. Yeah. But he says, like many disciplines, it seems neutral, but it isn't, in fact. So we have the law and economics stuff. At the same time, there's a Federalist Society, another sort of conservative bastion of legal thinking. It's funded with money from the Scaifes, the Kochs, and Olin, and is another really incredible example of how effective this idea and money machine can be. It has today it has 150 law school chapters. Every single Republican appointed judge on the Supreme Court are members of the Federalist Society.
Yes.
Dick Cheney, John Ashcroft, Edwin Meese, who we talked about previously.
Yeah, Meese was Reagan's attorney general, or one of them. And he's another one of those figures that you have to be pretty plugged in to know who he is, but he's definitely one of the most important figures on the right. I mean, he kind of toured the country giving speeches on behalf of originalism in the 80s. There was like a great debate. And it's also worth pointing out that the Federalist Society was co-founded by Eugene Meyer, who is the son of Frank Meyer, which astute listeners will know was a founding editor and senior editor at National Review. And Meyer was, well, he kind of ran the back of the magazine, kind of coordinated their book reviews and whatnot. But he also wrote a book called In Defense of Freedom, which is kind of the theoretical defense of fusionism, which is to say why libertarians and moral traditionalists should get along.
Right.
Kind of explaining why this mishmash of conservative ideas, like the mix of anti-communism and traditional values and economic free market stuff, why it all fits. But yeah, the Federalist Society is, the left should envy the Federalist Society.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know of any organization on the right that's been that effective.
Yeah.
To be honest.
We can see it playing out right now.
Yeah.
The Trump administration has outsourced their entire approach to appointing judges at all levels of the judiciary to the Federalist Society.
Yeah.
Like the Trump administration, which we look at and we see it's a complete disaster in so many ways. Nothing's going well. But the judiciary, the judicial appointments part is a well-oiled machine. It's humming along.
Yeah.
It's purring. And there's just a wave of judges who have the imprimatur of the Federalist Society being appointed at every level. And that's going to have like an impact for a generation.
That was the argument for voting for Trump if you were a right-winger.
Right.
Hold your nose, vote for Trump, he'll appoint Federalist Society judges.
It's a good argument.
And you know what? Promise fulfilled.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And one more thing about law and economics we wanted to mention is that Elizabeth Warren was once under the sway of this way of thinking.
Yeah, this Henry Mann character. In the recent New York Times piece about Elizabeth Warren's political evolution, her change of mind from a Republican or Republican-leaning person to a progressive Democrat, there's a whole section in the New York Times piece on the law and economics stuff.
Yeah.
And she was kind of under the sway of those ideas when she undertook her work on bankruptcy.
Right.
And, well, as we now know, she kind of assumed all these people were cheats, scamming the government, trying to get off for their poor decisions. And she realized, actually, that wasn't the case. That these people just fell on hard times and kind of got underwater.
Yeah. One of the admirable things about Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons I like her. Like, say what you want, so Sam catches shit being a Warren bro. But one of the reasons I like her personally, probably more than any candidate.
Yeah.
Like, just as a person, I think she has a lot of integrity, and I think changing her mind based on research and evidence is...
It's appealing.
It's
But I want to say for the record, for my... critics, that I am still a Bernie supporter, ride or die. but I do like Elizabeth Warren. Yeah. Okay, one more thing I wanted to say about judges is the seminars for judges that are funded by these foundations. So you got the Cokes and the Olin Foundation funding these cushy, you know, on location seminars for sitting judges. The Olin Foundation sends them to Key Largo and it's on a resort, and they spend like 2 hours being drilled with pro-corporate jurisprudence, and then they get to go golfing.
To spend an afternoon at the pool.
Yeah, just imagine like Ruth Bader Ginsburg snorkeling and then going to the... because that's actually in the book.
Her and Clarence Thomas at the pool together.
Well, they are friendly, right? Well, she was very friendly with Scalia, they say. But Mayer does mention that both Clarence Thomas and Ruth Bader Ginsburg went to this, along with her estimate is 660 other judges who went to these lavish trips where it's a seminar. But like these judges are really just going for a trip. But it's being funded by these right-wing think tanks, right-wing foundations, which want them to rule in particular ways. So it's pretty dark.
This is an important wrinkle in their strategy. People think that sometimes all this money just goes to the most committed ideologues, but there's always a base level. I kind of mentioned this with the IHS stuff, where they spread the money, the trips, the seminars, etc. They spread them around nice and wide. And it's not because they think everyone will be converted. It's just... when you familiarize people with the ideas, they become a little more sympathetic to them, I think.
I wanted to just talk a little bit more about Heritage Foundation because Matt had interned there.
That's a revelation, Sam. Previously on this podcast, I believe I had only said I had interned.
Oh, yes. You were very precious about
unnamed,
it.
Yes. Yeah. I was a little... well, as this podcast goes along, I'm revealing more and more of my...
you really are.
Myself to listeners.
Yeah.
But no, I did intern at the Heritage Foundation the summer after I graduated from college. So I was all of 22. But, you know, since we had talked about the universities and these beachheads and the law and economics stuff and kind of the Federal Society, you know, it is worth kind of mentioning the think tank aspect of this, which is sort of the second phase of Dick Fink's strategy. And... the Heritage Foundation is especially interesting because they were geared mainly toward influencing legislative debates and policy on Capitol Hill, which
is taking a different approach than previously right-wing think tanks had.
Right. So so the American Enterprise Institute, AEI, they had predated Heritage, but they really weren't super effective because their scholars sort of did what you would expect of scholars, which is like produce these, you know, research papers that weren't specifically tied to various and specific legislative debates.
And they were long.
Right. But Heritage, which was founded by Ed Fulner and Paul Weyrich in the 70s, they were geared specifically towards influencing legislative debates. And the idea was to produce like short white papers, like literally third grade reading level bullet points saying like, here's the right wing take on this issue. Here's how you should vote. And here's the kind of like basic logic why you should vote that way.
Right. And that's like effective because like legislators don't like to read. I mean, as we know from like the Mueller report shit, like none of them read
it. Like this, like these position papers literally would be something that if a member of Congress walked out of his office to the floor to vote,
he could hand it to
an aide could hand it to him in the intervening walk and he or she could spend, 2 minutes looking at it and kind of have a sense of what to do. So, I don't have any particularly ghoulish stories from my days at Heritage, but it was a really interesting model to consider because Heritage it's right on Capitol Hill.
Yeah.
I lived there. Like, they built intern housing above the main, offices. So
you lived in the intern housing?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, and it was right on Capitol Hill.
Talk about vertical integration.
I know, right? So it was right on Capitol Hill. And the other thing they do is hold these seminars with not necessarily congressmen. I mean, they probably do, but also like staffers, Capitol Hill staffers, where they would order pizza and, some speaker would come in and give a presentation. So the Capitol Hill staffers.
Just imagine little 22-year-old Matt.
I know.
But bright-eyed, bushy-tailed.
In my poorly fitting suit.
Poorly fitting suit. Oh, his dad's suit. getting so excited to eat the pizza.
Yeah. But it was just interesting. And of course, you're indoctrinated into the whole heroic story of conservatism.
Right. Well, you especially because you were working with the in-house historian.
Right, yes. I interned for Lee Edwards, Dr. Lee Edwards. who was the, again, I forget what his title was, but he was the in-house conservative historian. And
so speaking of the kind of the Whiggish history of conservatism, you were definitely given that.
Yeah. And I mean, it was frankly a plum internship.
I'm sure.
Like, of all the things you could spend your summer doing in D.C., doing historical and archival research for a thoughtful guy who treated me really well.
Right.
I didn't get coffee or make photocopies. I was like reading books and writing him memos.
I wanted to say three other things quickly about Paul Weyrich, who's one of the co-founders.
Yeah, sure.
He also created the Republican Study Committee, which is really like the first congressional caucus that has like just deep and direct ties to the conservative movement's think tanks.
Yes.
One of the members says to Mayer, I think they might be anonymous in the book, says, "We are basically a conduit to and from the Heritage Foundation, to and from conservative members of the House." So you can see how that works. That's the Republican Study Committee. Weyrich,
the moral majority, right?
Right. Moral majority with Jerry Falwell, just bringing religious conservatives into the pro-corporate fold, which very effectively. And then he also launched, with funding from SCAFE, the American Legislative Exchange Committee, ALEC.
Right.
Which is sort of, especially at the state level, state legislative level, writing pieces of legislation that conservatives can then put forward.
Yeah. Weyrich is someone who, again, is not as well known as certain figures, but is one of the most, absolutely most important people on the right.
Yeah.
And the building of the
quietly
of the conservative institutions. And the right wingers really got how important the states were.
Yeah.
They, I think, understood that far better than the left. And because, I mean, I don't know if you've ever worked in state politics.
I lobbied on behalf of a union in Providence state legislature.
When I was one of my, actually probably the summer before I interned at Heritage, I interned for the pro tem of the Pennsylvania State Senate.
Mm.
If you've ever worked in state government, like, sorry, this is mean, but like,
true.
The biggest idiots in the world.
Such
like,
big
like
idiots.
Total mediocrity.
They're all like real estate lawyers.
Yeah. And the idea, like if you have any kind of connection to these bigger money, more sophisticated right-wing outfits, like, you can just steamroll these state legislators.
They really are.
And so the right, you credit to the right
credit
for realizing
right.
that, but that's had all kinds of consequences. You control state legislatures, you control redistricting and gerrymandering and all that stuff.
Yeah. So we're going to try to get wrapped up here, and we wanted to talk about what is the third element of the three-part system, which is funding the troops at the ground level.
Right.
And one of the things about the Mayer book is in the second half, it's really like the last two-thirds, is very focused on the Obama years and focused on the funding of the Tea Party by the Kochs.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how she kind of closes out the book. And, you know, this is a part of the book that I mentioned at the very start of the podcast, Theda Skocpol, the great political scientist who wrote a book on the Tea Party, reviewed Dark Money for Dissent, actually. And so Mayer's approach is criticized by Skocpol for being a bit top-down, meaning it sort of sees the Tea Party movement as being the creation, almost, of the money spent by the Koch brothers, in particular, on these so-called grassroots, you might call them AstroTurf organizations.
Yeah.
And one of Skocpol's criticisms is that Mayer takes the kind of word of activists and the figures involved in this organization, right, for kind of taking credit. So there is some dispute about how best to understand the Tea Party movement. Both of them admit that it's sort of a feedback loop, like that the people in the grassroots did exist, the money amplified their voices, gave them funding and strategy, but there was a grassroots movement to kind of oppose Obama.
Yeah.
The character of that movement is, well, I don't think it's really up for debate. I think the Kochs want to see it as more like small government stuff. But as Skocpol points out in her book on the Tea Party, it really was based much more about immigration and kind of quote unquote demographic change.
And Obama's
basically a racialized fear of Obama, a racist fear of Obama, you should say. I don't want to sound like the New York Times. but it is the third kind of leg of this stool. So we talked about the universities and the think tanks. Now we're to the grassroots, so-called grassroots activism, the kind of pressure on legislators. And one of the things Mayer points out, at one point she calls the Koch organization sort of parasitic on the Republican Party. Yeah. Basically, they infiltrated the Republican Party.
Yeah.
And all these legislators feared primaries from the right.
Yeah.
And so that's the story she tells in the last few hundred pages of the book.
I guess I would say that where I would differ is, like, I think AstroTurf is it's a very appealing ideal to liberals because it suggests that there actually isn't any grassroots genuine support for conservative ideas. It's always funded by these right-wing billionaires. So it's kind of, it's a get-out-of-jail-free card. It gives liberals a pass for not having convinced people of their ideas, right? And it also ignores the fact that there actually is a genuine appeal to conservative ideas, especially when they are in defense of white supremacy. And the basis for Joe Biden's campaign is to go back before Trump, right?
Right.
The idea being that before Trump, there wasn't all this crazy racism and there wasn't all these people whose like politics are organized around being anti-immigrant, but there was. And the idea of AstroTurf sort of gives liberals, it contributes to that delusion that there isn't
Isn't real at some level.
Yeah, and it is. And I think it'd be smarter to think about it is, I can't be the only person who said this, but like, you know, it's not AstroTurf, it is grassroots, but the Kochs and all of the right-wing billionaires are providing fertilizer, or they're spraying it with water.
Whatever metaphor
you want.
Their
sunlight, you know.
They amplify these voices. And, and sometimes it might be the case that this anger at Obama was somewhat inchoate, and then the Americans for Prosperity, which has a lot of state chapters and local chapters, which is true.
Yeah.
They fund kind of almost organizers at a somewhat more local level. They might have given these people some of the language to use or focus some of that anger towards specific legislative issues like Obamacare. But it really did. It started with the bailouts. And one of the interesting things you see in the book is that, you know, the Koch brothers have these donor summits,
right,
where they gather a bunch of rich people and they listen to lectures and hear right-wing politicians speak. And the very first one of these they had is described by Mayer as being pretty pathetic.
Yeah.
It's kind of like boring. Not many people showed up, like fewer than 20 people. And then by the time you get to the Obama years, there's like a lot of people at these things.
It's an event.
Ted Cruz is like giving these, you know, red meat speeches. There's a lot of energy there. They're pouring even more money into the political battles. But it's worth, Sam pointed out that the, you know, Biden's candidacy is premised on going back behind the Trump years, that this is some kind of aberration. But I think one of the most interesting things Trump has said, and this is in the preface or the introduction to Tim Alberta's book, American Carnage, is he scored this interview with Trump, and Trump said, you know, all these people who are in the Tea Party, they're still here. Now they're just saying, make America great again.
Yeah. That's really clarifying. And like one way we might think about the Koch's influence on the Tea Party is like, okay, there's this inchoate rage, and maybe it's partially racial and partially rooted in these kind of genuine economic grievances, the feeling that the bailouts, you know, saved the banks but didn't save any people and any real people. But the Kochs provide this framework for directing this rage into libertarian policy ideas. But, you know, maybe in the absence of that, the Tea Party is a more openly racist movement. You know what I mean?
Right.
The aspects of the Tea Party that are now, well, I think Trump is right. And and the aspects of the Tea Party that were sort of subsumed in, or at least channeled into, this language about small government are now openly expressed in the form of Trump supporters. And the last thing about that, I think it's worth acknowledging that there is not no connection between libertarianism and small government and anti-federal power stuff and kind of a racist or racial agenda, because of course, like, historically, the power of the federal government is the power to enforce civil rights law.
Right.
And there's always an idea when people are railing against government spending that it's spending on behalf of people of color, people who aren't deserving, the undeserving poor who are racialized as non-white.
Right.
So there is a way in which their racial attitudes can be effectively channeled into the libertarian stuff. And there is a connection there.
And, you know, Mayer points out that one of the, I forget whether he worked for, I think he worked for FreedomWorks, but I can't say for sure whether he worked for FreedomWorks or Americans for Prosperity. But one of the key organizers of the Tea Party stuff was this guy named Brendan Steinhauser, who I'm pretty sure I met back in the day in D.C. But he, she describes him as like trying to make sure no racist stuff showed up on the signs at Tea Party protests. Right. And he failed sometimes. Like, they couldn't totally scrub it of that influence.
Right, and it is clarifying. You have Trump saying that the Tea Party became MAGA, and it's really a sign of the pragmatism of the Kochs that, like Matt and I were talking before, that, you know, if the Kochs had their way, it wouldn't have been Trump, right? He wouldn't have been the nominee. It would have been Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz, the real Tea Party guys. It became Trump, and they were able to shift. And as we know, by the time Trump is celebrating his victory, who is at the party but David Koch?
Yeah.
So it's not like there is this sort of fundamental ideological divide that can't be bridged.
Yeah. And it speaks to the importance of having the infrastructure there, because candidates will come and go. Yeah. Politicians will come and go. Someone will be elected and eventually they'll not be in office.
Yeah.
But the permanent infrastructure waging the ideological wars
is there.
Is what allows them to, even when something unexpected or even from one perspective, like not what they wanted to have happened, i.e. Trump being elected,
yeah,
they can still press on.
And they
on.
Exert influence over Trump. Like, yeah. You know, we've talked about this before. If Steve Bannon had his way, I think there would have been a huge infrastructure bill, and there would have been a bunch of government spending that would have actually benefited some of the working class-ish people who voted for Trump. And there would have been something behind this sort of welfare chauvinism, which is now it's just rhetoric. It's populist rhetoric without any populist policy. Yeah. And you might argue that the standing conservative infrastructure that is so hostile to any kind of redistributive economics, even if it's redistributive economics only for white people, is a check on Trump's populist impulses.
Because it would take someone far more intelligent, disciplined, and savvy at the level of like policy details to overcome that infrastructure.
Right.
And it is telling too that like one of the figures that pops up in Mayer's book is Wilbur Ross.
Yeah.
Because he was another one of these kind of goons who, you know, wanted the government to regulate as little as possible, and now he's what Trump's commerce secretary,
and the architect of the question of the citizenship question on the census 2020 census, which we've talked about before.
So in a way, we have come full circle back to the Nazi origins of the Koch project. that's an exaggeration, but it
we
is telling
be clear-eyed
the,
about
the Tea Party. You know, Mayer says, you know, they weren't calling for Social Security to be cut.
Yeah.
They weren't calling, you know, these kind of, the welfare that's coded as okay for white people. That's not, the Tea Party didn't care about any of that.
No.
It was, you know, the black man taking over our healthcare.
Yeah.
And again, that's a Frank Luntz focus group tested language.
What's the language?
Government takeover.
Right.
That was what the right decided, based on Frank Luntz's research, should be the way they talk about Obamacare. And then the bailouts, too. I mean, which there are real criticisms of the bailout, but it's also the case that, like, you know, I mean, basically the Koch brothers, they fought the bailout until it was clear that, like, if the U.S. government did not do something to infuse capital into some of these banks in the next 24 to 48 hours, the world economy would collapse. And then they relented. And there was actually a letter circulated, like, congressmen saying, like, the Kochs have signed off on this.
Yeah. All right, well, let's wrap it up. I think we've covered a lot here. This is like kind of an infinite information dump. I hope that it was helpful. I mean, a lot of people have asked for sort of more meat on the bones of the idea of like the conservative pipeline. I think that we covered some of that.
Yeah.
And I don't know, Matt, do you have any like final thoughts about this?
I do think Mayer's book, I hadn't read it before. I'd always
Me neither.
And I have, you know, been aware of it. But I do think she does a really good job of giving you some of the history involved, where the foundations got this money, the kind of tax structures that shield them, some of the personalities involved. And then once she gets into some of the particulars of the right-wing network, the kind of three-pronged approach that they took, we didn't talk as concretely about the Tea Party as we might, because I do think later on we might want to do just like a Tea Party focused episode.
We talked about doing Tim Alberta's book.
Yeah, that maybe we'll read like Theda Skocpol's book and Tim Alberta's book together, or some combination like that. But yeah, this is I think it does really help flesh out some of the particular ideas on the right when it comes to how they use their money, the networks they've created, the organizations they've created, and how it operates on, well, at least three different levels.
Yeah. I don't know how helpful this will be, but as I was reading this book, my girlfriend was reading Eugenie Grandet, the Balzac book, and she read to me this passage about misers. So I was reading about the Cokes, and she was read to me about the miser in Balzac. And I'm going to read you a passage. Balzac writes of this character, Felix Grandet, in the book. Like all misers, he had a constant need to pit his wits against those of other men, to mulct them of their crowns by fair legal means, to get the better of others. Was that not exercising power, giving oneself with each new victim the right to despise those weaklings of the earth who are unable to save themselves from being devoured? Oh, has anyone properly understood the meaning of the lamb lying peacefully at God's feet, the most touching symbol of all the victims of this world and of their future, the symbol of which is suffering and weakness glorified? The miser lets the lamb grow fat. Then he pens, kills, cooks, eats, and despises it. Misers thrive on money and contempt.
Well, it's interesting that the Lamb of God is invoked there, because I was going to say, you know, this episode began by mentioning David Koch's death, and I think it's fair to say that he should hope God's more merciful than he ever was in his life.
That is exactly right.
You know, call me superstitious, call me whatever you want, but I believe we face judgment after our deaths.
And, in this case, I hope that we do. For my sake, I hope that we don't, but for David Koch, I hope that we do. All right, so that's Know Your Enemy, episode 8.
Yeah, thanks for listening, and just as a reminder, there will be a bonus episode on Patreon coming up for our much-valued and much-loved subscribers.
Yeah, please do, if you have the means, sign up, subscribe to us on Patreon. There's going to be more and more goodies coming your way if you're a Patreon subscriber, even at the $5 level. Thanks a lot. Thanks for listening. Listen next time to Know Your Enemy. Thanks, Matt.
Bye-bye.